I'm not a member of this wonderful church, and in fact, I'm not a Unitarian Universalist, but I know that you use care about one's personal journey, so today I'm going to talk about a part of my career as a pediatric endocrinologist that was a personal journey, the impact of which changed my view of science and medical dogma, what it means to be a caregiver, and to paraphrase the Hippocratic Oath, what it truly means to do no harm. I'm sure many of you have visited a newborn nursery, maybe because you were a new parent or a grandparent or a friend or family member had a new baby. You probably noticed that the babies were wearing little hats to keep their little heads warm, blue hats for boys and pink hats for girls. What most people don't know is that nurseries also keep white hats on hand, and they're for babies who can't be identified as male or female when they're born. I spent over 30 years as a practicing pediatric endocrinologist, actually right here in Rhode Island, and like other ped endos, I was a go-to person whenever a baby was born and the people in the nursery couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl. You might think that this hardly ever happens, but it's actually not that rare. And in any given year in Rhode Island, with its 10,000 or so births, there would be at least a few such babies born, and sometimes as maybe as 8 or 10 a year. As I'm sure you can imagine, the birth of one of these babies was a serious trauma for their parents and families. When you have a baby, or these days when you're going to have a baby, the first thing everybody asks is not, is the baby healthy or how much do they weigh? It's, is it a boy or a girl? And this binary view of sexuality shaped how pediatric endocrinologists and surgeons approached babies with what used to be referred to as intersex disorders. When I was training as a ped endo in the early 80s, here's what I was taught about how to take care of these babies. The first principle was that a baby's gender could be assigned at birth, presumably by a doctor. And as the baby grows up, they'll accept whatever gender is assigned. And the gender should be based on what the medical diagnosis predicts, but also whether or not surgery can be done to make the baby's genitals look normal. And looking normal was thought to be critical to the baby becoming a child who views himself as a boy or a girl. The next principle was that a baby who's raised as a male but has a small penis will lead a life of shame and loneliness. This meant that surgery almost always involved removing tissue because surgeons could make a small phallus smaller, but they couldn't make a small phallus bigger. In other words, when babies were born with a phallus that was halfway between a penis and a clitoris, the baby would be assigned female, and the phallus would be reduced in size, or if you go back to the 1950s or 60s, it would actually be removed. To be clear, all of the physicians and psychologists who put forward this approach were men, and it appears that none of them ever bothered to ask any women about whether or not size really matters. The last principle, and a really critical one, was the idea that the assigned gender would only be accepted by the individual if the baby was raised unambiguously. The parents raised the baby unambiguously. And this led to some things that were routine and now, through the lens of time and ethical consideration, seems pretty shocking. First of all, the doctor should not always tell the parents the truth about their baby's chromosomes, about their genetic makeup, because it could be too confusing and lead to a sense of ambiguity on the part of the parents. Next, doing the appearance-altering surgery should be treated as an emergency because any abnormal appearance should be as limited in time as possible. So surgery to make the genitals, parents were told, to make the genitals look normal was medically necessary, safe, and effective, and it had to be done as soon as possible, well before a child could assent to the procedure. And years later, it became known that some surgery often resulted in permanent sexual dysfunction. Lastly, in many cases, it was considered best to not reveal to the child themselves, as they were growing up, the nature of their disorder. So as you can imagine, all of this led to a culture of shame. Also implicit in the approach was that any failure of the child to accept their assigned gender was the fault of the parents. And all of this was what I was taught to do, and I didn't question it. After all, the basis for it seemed irrefutable. a famous sexologist, Johns Hopkins, John Money, had reported many times over the perfect case to justify an unambiguous and irreversible sex assignment at birth. He had taken care of a baby whose penis was accidentally destroyed during a circumcision. The baby was an identical twin, so Money had a control subject, if you will. Because the baby's penis was gone, Money assigned female gender, then reported in over 80 articles and book chapters that everything had worked out just fine. But in 1997, the reality of the case was made public. The person in question, referred to by Money as John Joan, was living as a 30-something married man and father. A couple of years before the John Joan case became public, I was approached by a Brown professor of biology and anthropology, Ann Faustus Sterling, about a teenager who had contacted her. This teenager had been born with ambiguous genitals and had been assigned female. Now at the age of 13, she was being forced to take estrogen pills, and this was more than upsetting because she knew that she was a he. A case like this hadn't ever been reported in the medical literature, but Anne, along with many of her colleagues, suspected that the John Joan case was an illegitimate basis for a very flawed approach. And long story short, I helped Matt switch to male, and in the course of all of this, Anne introduced me to the founder of the Intersex Society of North America, Cheryl Chase. I actually became the first pediatrician to sign on to Cheryl's advisory committee for ISNA. And I brought her to a meeting of the Pediatric Endocrine Society. This caused quite a stir, to say the least, but the next year, with some pushing and cajoling, Cheryl was actually asked to speak. She told an audience of 300 pediatric endocrinologists that one of their senior and most respected colleagues had arranged for her clitoris to be removed when she was an infant. The discussions that ensued were painful for the community of ped endos, but they resulted in the standards of care being changed over the next 10 years. Although there persists some resistance to this, those being trained in our discipline are now taught that they should be truthful, that an assigned gender may be wrong in as many as a third of these cases, and that surgery, appearance-altering surgery, is not an emergency. It may not be effective, and it should be delayed until the child is developed into a boy or a girl and can actually assent to the surgery. One of the reasons I chose this subject for today is that I'm a medical educator, and my experience relating to sex development shaped who I was as a physician and a caregiver and also as an educator. One of the things that changed me the most was getting to know and work with some remarkable people, none of whom were physicians. As you probably know, doctors mostly learn from other doctors how to be doctors. And I'm not sure that's the best thing, and I think there may be a better way. I already mentioned Ann Faustus Sterling. Getting to know Ann and her work taught me just how much the humanities could tell us about how to care for our patients. Ann knew what was right in a field that was the domain of some very powerful senior physicians and psychologists, all men, who were the recognized authorities. And she knew because she knew the science of human sexuality and the historical context. I also mentioned that Anne introduced me to Cheryl Chase, and that's actually a pseudonym, one of several that Cheryl's used in her career, and her real name is Beau Laurent. I think Beau is a genius. She graduated from MIT with a degree in mathematics, and very early in the development of the field of computer science, she went on to be a programmer. She was recruited to Japan to do that work. Later on, she decided to deal with what I guess was really the most challenging thing in her life, knowing her identity and dealing with the harm that had been done to her. The result was a powerful patient advocate who changed the field of medicine and saved many, many other people from a great deal of harm. The third person who helped me on my journey was Alice Drager. Alice is a medical historian and ethicist. She's a wonderful writer with a sardonic but hilarious sense of humor. And with Alice's help, I realized that I'd been blindly obedient to my medical predecessors and their dogma. History can indeed put things into perspective. And in her book, Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex, Alice used historical case studies to tell how we got to where we were. And by the way, this history included a pope who was actually a biological female. Beyond this whole subject, if you want a stimulating view of scientific controversy and the meaning of intellectual freedom, you should read Alice's more recent book, Galileo's Middle Finger. So back to why I chose to talk about all of this today. This experience of mine exemplified for me the importance of recognizing the autonomy of the individual and to do so on the basis of scientific facts and standards of ethical behavior. I can't help but think about this in the context of the current political climate. To deny a rational approach to gender self-identification and sexual orientation is to take an approach that belies science, facts, and basic human dignity, and in my mind, it's right up there with the climate isn't changing, racism isn't a problem anymore, and the Earth is the center of the universe. And I know that last one is ancient history, but I'm a recovering Catholic, so I had to mention it. So the next time you hear someone say that if you're not a heterosexual man or woman, you're not normal and you need to be fixed, you can remind yourself that the science says that that view is a bunch of hooey. We're meant to figure out during our times as children and adolescents and adults who we are and who we want to share our lives with. And to deprive us of that opportunity is to take away that most fundamental right to live our lives as the person we actually are. As I mentioned in my opening, I'm not a UU, but my wife Martha, who is, tells me that UUs care about one's personal journey and personal discovery. Martha also told me about the principles of Unitarian Universalism, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, the importance of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and that there should be a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So in retrospect, I think that these principles were actually what motivated me to change my approach to infants and children with differences in sex development. So in conclusion, I guess I can say maybe I'm more of a UU than I thought I was.